Hello and welcome to episode 11 of DFA, a podcast from Baseball Prospectus. I'm Brian Grosnick of BP, and we've got Zach Kreiser of BP as well joining us today for our show. Zach, how's it going?
It's going good. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm excited to get back in the swing of things and talk about some of these huge moves that are happening all across baseball right now. I joke about that. It seems like every week we have less and less to talk about in terms of, you know, we've got guys hitting the DL on the regular, and that happens every week. But we actually have a real trade today, so that's going to be fun. We'll talk about that a little later in the show. We've got our usual assortment of guys being called up, guys being sent down, going to the disabled list. But we're going to start things off with kind of a surprise return to baseball from a guy that we may have figured was out of the league at this point. But our big move of the day is going to be the call-up of Edwin Jackson by the Baltimore Orioles. Yes, the Baltimore Orioles, who are ostensibly contending for the AL East title, have called up Edwin Jackson, who has become something of a punchline over the last couple of years because he's been, I don't know, do you want to say just bad or terrible? I mean, there's a lot of different adjectives we could kind of use to describe his pitching performance. But he's back.
He seems to be living off that no-hitter still.
I mean, it's and what a wild no-hitter that was. I mean, it was definitely one of the worst no-hitters I've ever seen. But that's a heck of an achievement. So yeah, Edwin Jackson's back. Why would we be interested in talking about this?
Well, he is approaching the all-time record for most franchises played for. I have the list from Baseball Reference up, and it's been updated since last night, or I think it was last night he finally got into a game for the Orioles, and he's at 12. He has played for 12 franchises. I'm not going to list them. But
We can do that. But I mean, what would be a good cross section? I mean, what were the teams he was most famous for pitching for? He started his career with the Dodgers, went on to the Rays, and then he kind of did the whole journeyman thing, was traded a bunch of times. His transaction history is pretty interesting. Went through the Tigers, the Diamondbacks, spent like half a season for a bunch of different teams, and then eventually signed with the Cubs, where he kind of fell apart, right?
Sure, he was definitely a part of whether the Cubs meant to tank or not. He helped them down that road, and he went 8-18 in 2013.
Ugly.
Yeah, so the Cubs and the Rays are where I remember him most, and then of course the Padres. But yeah.
Yeah, of course the Padres. You say it that way because he was bad and with the Padres, and that's just kind of been the thing for the last couple of years. He got into 13 starts with the Padres last year, despite not putting up more than a 5.89 ERA in that time with the team. He was not good. It's kind of been this running joke that the Padres pitching has been so bad. So after being so bad with them, after being bad as a reliever with the Marlins last year, he pitched in the minors for Baltimore this year, and now he's back up with the team. So what's Baltimore doing here? I mean, isn't he kind of pitched himself out of the league at this point?
You would think. I think there are a lot of people who have seemingly been out of the league and still end up on the Orioles somehow. it's unbelievable how far their roster spans from Manny Machado and Zach Britton and some of the great players that helped them contend, Adam Jones. And then just at the bottom, they just don't put any effort into finding like replacement level players. They just go below the line and end up with the Edwin Jacksons and the just incredible levels of dearth of talent for a contending team. And I guess they've somehow done that here again with a bullpen that theoretically was one of the best coming into the season, and now has, because of injuries, taken a turn.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to see because you mentioned Britton before, and Britton is this all-world closer, but he's been injured and out of the picture, so it's been kind of down to Brock and O'Day and then Givens. So they've got three good relievers in the bullpen right now. It just so happens that they don't have more than three good relievers, and the bullpen features guys now like Jackson and Ubaldo Jimenez, who were, it would be fun to see him in the starting rotation in 2009, but 8 years down the line, it's pretty ugly. Wade Miley has been pitching really well in the rotation, but there's not a lot of depth in the rotation, not a lot of depth in the bullpen, and there's certainly not a lot of depth in the actual lineup either at this point, right?
Nope. There's so little depth that they managed to acquire Ruben Tejada, I think, last week from the Yankees off waivers, maybe. And then they called him up from Norfolk yesterday, and he got into a game immediately for a team that is contending for the AL East. Ruben Tejada made it into a game for a contender, and they've had some real struggles with JJ Hardy and some other guys in the lineup not performing like you'd want. But again, you expect a team that's contending to have some option beyond Ruben Tejada. And the guy they sent down to get Ruben Tejada up was Paul Janish, who is also just nothing. So it's not like there was an obvious thing that they passed over.
Yeah, on the last episode that we had, RJ and I talked a little bit about Paul Janish and how we had completely forgotten that he was still in the league, and yet here he is. Now, it's kind of weird because the Orioles have multiple bodies in AAA. We talked a little bit about this last time. They've got a collection of former minor leaguers with their AAA team. They've got Luis Sardinas, they've got Johnny Giavitella, but Sardinas, while he's a shortstop, Giavitella is not really a shortstop. So if they need a guy who can spell Hardy, you could kind of see why they would have gone for Tejada. But I mean, it's hard to imagine Tejada is an upgrade over Sardinas. And even if he is maybe just a fraction of an upgrade, I mean, is it enough to actually go out and get him and add him to the 40?
I doubt it. I don't know. I can't imagine Ruben Tejada. If you're trying to fill in for JJ Hardy or something of the sort there, the minute difference in offensive output there is probably more than outweighed by, I mean, I've never thought of Ruben Tejada as a good defensive player. I'm not entirely sure I'm correct in thinking that, but I just never did.
No, you're not far off. As a guy who watched a lot of Ruben Tejada over the last decade, he is not a good defensive shortstop. He's an adequate defensive shortstop, and he was a lot better when he was younger, but he's not particularly great, and now it seems like he's gotten less and less engaged when he plays, and so he's gotten worse. But then again, when you're splitting time between the Cardinals and the Giants and the Yankees and the Orioles, I mean, you can kind of understand why he'd be a little down. It's surprising to me that he fell so far so fast. I mean, when you're a player in the major leagues who's playing at a moderately high level at such a young age, like Tejada was, there really isn't a lot of failure in the history of those kinds of players who come up early, extra early, get a regular shot at playing time, and then most of the time, they at least have some sort of solid major league career into their 30s, usually. So Tejada's kind of a weird exception to the rule.
Yeah, absolutely. And he, after the Chase Utley broken leg saga and everything, he ended up with the Cardinals organization to in 2016. And I mean, to me, that was like the bat signal that he was about to turn into
Right.
that great major league player, like pretty much immediately because the Cardinals picked him up. But that very much did not happen. He ended up with the Giants also in 2016, and then obviously started out this season in the Yankees farm system. But it's which he was hitting well in AAA for the Yankees, I'll give him that. But AAA, it's not necessarily been the problem.
No, not at all. So we talk about how the Orioles need somebody to spell JJ Hardy. He's still doing all right defensively, but boy, his offense seems to have just completely cratered. His average is down to almost nothing, which is not that different than his usual hitting abilities. He's really a guy who relies on his power and his defense, but the power seems to have dropped off quite a bit too. And the Orioles are really kind of struggling now to keep up with the top of this AL East. Do you think they're going to need to do something maybe a little bit more drastic to try to improve over Hardy, or do you think he might just regress a little bit, or is this kind of the downslope of a career that was already kind of declining?
Okay, so J.J. Hardy is 34 years old, 9 months. I can't imagine he's going to be quite this bad. He's still hitting. He's actually always hit a good amount of fly balls. Like you said, he's relied on power, and his homer per fly ball rate this year is extremely low, especially for the current environment. So I'm guessing it regresses a little bit, and it's Baltimore. It'll get hot. The balls will start carrying a little more. But I do think that if they actually think they're going to contend, and I don't know that they are in a place where they should make that decision yet to go all in and contend this year, given the Yankees and the Red Sox playing really well right now, and the Blue Jays perhaps coming to offer a little bit more resistance, it may not be worth pushing all the chips in. But if they were to do it, I think they, I've heard, where is Zach Cozart going to go? Is there any contender that might be actually in the market for a shortstop when the Reds inevitably decide to shop around best player in baseball, Zach Cozart?
And, I was hoping you'd mention that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he's still the WARP leader right now. And the Orioles, if they are in contention, seem to be the spot for that. To me, I would think that he, one, fills that Orioles defense checklist, that he would fit into that defense. He's a very good defender, and he would work with that general team philosophy there. And then he's also hitting like a man possessed right now. And whether that continues or not, I don't know, but Baltimore is not the worst place to try and find out if it's going to continue. And if it doesn't, he's a rental and they let him go. But, they would be the team, if someone were going to trade for Zach Cozart, that it would make the most sense for them. I don't know if they have the assets to get it done, but that would be the target in my mind.
Yeah, I think it's fun to talk about Zach Cozart, because I think there's almost no chance he would finish out the season with the Reds, I would think, because the Reds are not going to contend. If he does have this kind of emergent breakout season, which there were kind of hints of about a year ago, that he could really have made a big difference with his hitting profile, hitting the ball harder, thanks to that advice from Barry Larkin, which was hit the ball harder. It's unbelievable that would actually work. Like, I would just now go around and tell everybody to hit the ball harder and just see what happens, and then maybe you'll be a genius. It's hard to imagine he sticks in Cincinnati, because if he does play this well, he's going to get a lot more expensive, and that's probably not a position the Reds really want to be in. And if they don't give him up and try to get something back for him, they could lose him for nothing. But
could go back to being old Zach Cozart, and they would have missed a chance to sell incredibly high on a shortstop at the deadline.
Yeah, so you mentioned the Orioles are kind of a perfect fit. I was thinking about this, and it's really hard to imagine another really good fit. The only other team that seems to fit for me that I saw was potentially the Twins. And you got to think about, do the Twins really want to give much of anything up to compete for this American League Central? The Central is, a mess. It's very ugly right now, and they're kind of at the top of it, but it's a very close race right now, and the Indians are always kind of lurking. It's just this question of what you're going to have to give up. The Orioles don't seem to have the kind of depth in terms of young talent that the Twins do, but I think they would be more motivated to try to make a deal if they're close in a month or so.
Yeah, I think the Orioles window is just so very much over the next couple of years while they still have Machado, whereas the Twins they're not going to have a hard time telling their fans, okay, we're not going to go all out right now, but we've got these guys coming up through the system. Nick Gordon is playing well in whatever level he's at now, and if you wait another year, maybe we're right in this again. The Orioles don't exactly have that selling point.
Right.
The other outside shot at Zach Cozart that I thought about was if the Nationals decide that Trey Turner is the best solution to their center field issue, and then they want to plug the shortstop gap with Cozart. But I think that's probably not happening at this point, but that's just the other thought I had.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting thought, because as a one-year solution, I mean, again, you know, Cozart is going to be a free agent at the end of the season. That could be really worthwhile, because they can just shift Turner back to shortstop next year after Cozart moves on. And that would be, I mean, it's not really like the Nationals need to make a big move like that Cozart deal. Yeah. But they do have talent. They're obviously willing to deal their prospects, because, you know, they traded most of them for Adam Eaton last year. Good job, guys. That didn't work out so well. But yeah, next year they would just get Eaton back, and they would just be able to slide Turner back to shortstop. So yeah, I could see that working out. I don't know. You think the Diamondbacks could be a fit? They've got Chris Owings, but Chris Owings is kind of, he is having kind of a renaissance season, but they could also shift him to the outfield, where he's had some success playing center field, or they could try to shuffle things up in their middle infield. But I think Cozart would be enough of an upgrade that they could actually consider it. It just doesn't seem like it would be a really natural fit.
Yeah, I have absolutely no idea what the Diamondbacks are doing. It would surprise me just about equally if they traded some huge piece for like a win now, or if they just traded AJ Pollock away. I'm not really sure what they're going to do, but maybe they could trade them their trio of not that great shortstops and let the Reds figure it out. But yeah, that's another, if the Diamondbacks stay in contention, that's certainly another team that could use an upgrade there.
But I think the Orioles and the Reds, like you said, they match up really well. The Orioles have these holes. They have these depth holes. The Reds, aside from Cozart, probably don't have a star-level player, another star-level player to trade. But they do have some bullpen depth. They do have some okay starting pitchers that they could move over to the Orioles if they need another, you know, hand in the rotation or in the bullpen. They could send over a guy like, I don't know, Tony Cingrani, because they need a lefty for the bullpen. I mean, right now the lefty situation in the Baltimore bullpen is a little sketchy. I mean, really, most everything is sketchy at the back end of the depth, like we talked about. But yeah, I think that matches up really well. So we can go ahead and send that one into the commissioner's office and let them know that the move is good to go. I'm still kind of unsure about who the return would be for a team like the Reds. Would they want to take a gamble on perpetually injured Hunter Harvey? I don't think the Orioles would be interested in dealing Chance Cisco for a short-term rental of Zach Cozart. So it would have to be somebody a further level down. Just not sure who would match up perfectly for that.
Yeah, I'm not either, because I can't name many more Orioles prospects. They just aren't the brightest bunch or the most heralded bunch. It seems like the market, you know, if they are the only player for Zach Cozart, the market would play into their hands a little bit there. But yeah, they're not the most loaded team.
Well, I think part of the problem is that a lot of the prospect depth that the Orioles have is really like high A-level guys. I think their Frederick team's got a couple of good guys with Ryan Mountcastle, Cody Sedlock, a couple of other players. But again, you know, these are guys who probably wouldn't have much of an effect on a Cincinnati team until 2020, which, you know, Cincinnati would probably be interested in getting at least one player back who could have an immediate impact. I don't know, Trey Mancini? Like, I don't think the Orioles would be willing to deal him at this point, but
no,
I mean,
he's the perfect Oriole. He's a 6'4", goofy-looking guy who will hit home runs in Camden Yards till the sun burns out. I mean, he's perfect.
Yeah, it's just that they're loaded with 6'4", goofy-looking guys. I mean, what do you think they signed Chris Davis and Mark Trumbo for, you know? But you're right. He's playing too well. That's the point. You can't deal a guy who's playing that well and who's a little bit younger when you're looking to contend. I don't know. What do you think at this point? Do you think they come out of the East? Do you think they'll make a wild card? Or do you think the Red Sox and the Yankees are just going to kind of shove them to the side?
If I'm going with the logical me that, you know, that remembers that preseason projections and what the roster looked like to begin with is probably still more predictive than what's happened so far, I still, like, the Yankees have obviously gotten a huge jump and they're probably a contender now, and that's fine. And I think the Red Sox and Yankees are both going to push for the playoffs and probably both make it, if I had to guess. But in terms of the other wild card team, I would still be looking at probably the – I'm going to curse this for all of the baseball literati, but probably the Mariners are still a better contender to me than the Orioles in the AL landscape right now. And maybe the Angels if Trout comes back out, but probably not. So I would probably say that the Orioles are going to be battling it out with the Mariners and maybe the Twins or perhaps the Tigers. It's going to be close. I don't think the Orioles are going to drop totally out of it. I'd have a hard time seeing that in the AL this year.
I'm sorry, that is the incorrect answer. It is that the Orioles will make it back into the playoffs again because logic does not apply to this team. It's funny, if you look at the rest of season projected standings on Baseball Prospectus, there are two teams projected to be worse than the Orioles for the rest of the season. Those teams are the Kansas City Royals and the Los Angeles Angels. The Orioles are projected to be the third worst team in the American League for the rest of the season, which means that they are a virtual lock to make it back to the playoffs.
Yeah, I would be absolutely stunned if they're the third worst team in the AL for the rest of the season, not because I don't believe in the projections, just because they just don't do that.
Right. Yeah, it's tough to imagine. And, you know, it is still possible. They've had some players playing below their true talent level. I think most notably Manny Machado, who's been not having his best season up to this point. So there's a chance they could start righting the ship a little bit. Jonathan Scope seems to be hitting like a monster and maybe making a leap. So, you know, they could improve. It's tough to imagine. All the statistics seem to make us think that they're just not as good as they've been playing and not going to continue to be this good. And one of the reasons why they've been this good is Zach Britton, and Zach Britton is gone. You know, over the last couple of years, at least, Britton's been a reason. And, you know, he's not available right now. So I don't know. Maybe they're out of magic. Maybe they need a little bit of that Zach Cozart magic to make it back to the playoffs this year.
Yeah, I mean, if they manage to make the playoffs, their postseason rotation is going to confuse people to no end when they look back on this team. I mean, it's like halfway fulfilling his potential Dylan Bundy and then just nothing.
Yeah, Kevin Gausman and the return of Wade Miley's strikeout machine. And I don't know, maybe Tillman is the fourth guy then. But man, it's a weird one. Although you mentioned it's so weird to look back. I mean, do you remember the Royals rotation from like 2014 and 2015? That was pretty ugly too.
It was bad, yeah. I mean, the second year they obviously acquired Cueto, and before that it was just who is going to pitch.
Yeah. So, you know, we can't predict baseball. We will try to follow it. What do you think the odds are that either Tejada or Jackson will be on this Orioles roster on August 1st?
I give Tejada a much better chance just because the Orioles have like consistently employed Ryan Flaherty for the better part of 3 years. So I'll give Tejada a much better chance. I'll go like 25% for Tejada and like almost nothing for Jackson. When they get bullpen pieces back, he'll be gone.
I will go the other way. I think I'm going to go like 5% for Tejada because between Sardinas and Yanish and Flaherty, I just think they have too many other options. They may actually get somebody. So I'm low on Tejada, but with Jackson, they just cycle through these bullpen pieces. I wouldn't be surprised at all if he still comes back up and kicks around for a little bit. So I'm going to go with like a 30% on Jackson.
All right, we'll have to check on that particular wager on August 1st.
Oh, yeah, people are going to be absolutely chomping at the bit to find out how that turned out. All right, so we'll stay on the topic of shortstops a little bit. We're going to skip right into our quick hits portion of the show. Since Sean's not joining us today, it'll just be you and me, but I want to talk about a good shortstop again, like Zach Cozart, except someone who is just signed an extension with his team. The Seattle Mariners inked Gene Segura to a 5-year, $70 million extension. It's kind of a big deal. To me, I'm very surprised at this deal. What was your initial reaction when you heard this?
I was likewise surprised and a little confused. It seemed like a weird move to make with the team in the position it is in the standings right now, which, not that that should necessarily dictate any sort of deals with your current players, but it just felt like it was a move you make when everything's going great and you see a window and you want to, you know, you have Kyle Seager and Robinson Cano and Nelson Cruz for these next couple of years of their, for those guys, either their twilight or their late prime. Mm-hmm. And then you have Gene Segura, who is, if you think he's a core player, which certainly if he keeps playing like he did last year and like he has this year so far, looks like a core player. He's only 27. So, like, all of that on its own just makes sense to try and get this guy to sign an extension and stay with your team to kind of extend that window a little bit or strengthen your chances of taking advantage of it. But it just, the current, like, day it happened, it did not feel like something that was coming down the pipe.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with you, especially with him being injured, having that ankle issue. I'm kind of surprised that this would happen. Segura is such a weird player to get a handle on, I feel like, because of his, you know, relative badness in 2014, 2015 offensively. Then last year he had the breakout with his, the offense. He hit 20 homers. He was a really, really good offensive player for the Diamondbacks. Gets traded in the Taiwan Walker trade, comes to Seattle, and he's been a very good offensive player this year as well, but in kind of a different way. He's been very much a high batting average and high batting average on balls in play guy. He hasn't been hitting for quite as much power. And he's one of those shortstops who's not very flashy, but he has a lot of tools. He's a good base runner. He's always been high value base runner in terms of the base running metrics like ultimate base running or the base running runs at Baseball Prospectus. His defense is not what I would call elite, but it's probably average to a little bit above average. And he's the type of player who can slot in no matter what kind of team you're trying to put together, I feel like. Like, mm-hmm. He's not a guy where you really have to, like, you know, oh, we really want to lean on being a defense-heavy team, or, oh, we really want to lean on a team that's power over contact or something like that, because he can do a little bit of everything, which is good because the Mariners, I'm not sure they have a really strong identity, either offensively or defensively at this point. So whatever kind of direction the team goes in going forward, I think Segura can be a part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's hard to say. Maybe they've seen something in these, what, he's played about 40 games for them mm-hmm. this year. It seems like maybe they've seen something that makes them believe in what happened in Arizona. His power for, you know, his power in Arizona was probably a little bit aided by Arizona.
Sure.
But he slugged 499 last year, and it's only down to 462 this year. Mm-hmm. You know, less of that is coming with homers, more of it with doubles and things like that. But if they think that's real, then it makes a lot of sense to sign him. And if for some reason shortstop he phases out of shortstop, it probably won't be until Robinson Cano is perhaps ending his career and he can slide over to second anyway. So he's not a long-term like risk to not have a position. He has still been stealing consistently. His legs are still there. It seems like all of that makes sense. And if you factor in the explanations for his 2014 and 2015 seasons that were so rough, maybe you've got a long-term piece that people just didn't know what to make. They didn't know what to make of him until these past 2 years.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you. And I actually think the money's right for a deal like this. This 5 years and $70 million for a guy who's 27. So you're going to get those 27 through 32 seasons. I think this number, which is about, $13 million a year, somewhere around there, $13, $14 million per year, I think that works out pretty well for what a kind of a median expectation for Segura's performance might be. He looks like he's probably not a 5-win player like he was last year, but maybe something like a 2-win player. And for that amount at this position, going into not the downslope of a career, but hopefully the peak and end of peak, I think this is a pretty good value, and I think it's a pretty good investment because, you know, at some point there's the chance he has to move off the position. He seems like the type of piece that will continue to provide value on a contract like this as time goes on.
Yeah, sure. Even in those down years, by Baseball Prospectus WARP, he was still putting up value of at least 1.8 wins. In 2014, he was 3.7 wins by WARP, just by shortstop defense, and that'll level off a little bit, but now the offense is coming back. He seems like he's a very solid bet if he's healthy to make that contract good, at least.
So it'll be interesting to see, because I think you mentioned before that the Mariners are kind of in a weird position after this season where they have an aging roster. There's a lot of questions in the rotation, I feel like. Not a lot of help coming from the farm. It seems like this is a team where the window might be closing. Do you think that this, trying to run this team back, you know, maybe at the end of this season, maybe for next season, is going to be good enough? Or do you think they have to make another kind of splashy sort of Jerry DePoto move, not a million little Jerry DePoto moves, in order to really try to come out of this wild card and be a contender either at the deadline or for 2018?
It's tough. You don't exactly hear about the cavalry coming from the minors for the Mariners, although they have a couple of interesting pieces. I know there's a pitching prospect by the name of Andrew Moore, who is, from what I can tell, a guy who walks no one, has really nice ratios, and seems to be getting a lot of hubbub on the Mariners blogosphere, who might be someone who could theoretically be ready on the early side of things, maybe by the end of this year, but certainly sometime next year. And then they also have Tyler O'Neill, who seems to have taken a step back, maybe. I don't think he's performing in the minors very well. So I don't think you're getting a bunch of prospects to come save the day. I still, like, very much think that Mitch Haniger might save the day. I think he's a great player, and he's coming back sometime in the next week or so. And that should help them, and maybe that helps them see what they've got and see what they need to do. But boy, after James Paxton, that rotation gets really sketchy really, really fast. And so if you're going to make a move to improve this team, I think it almost has to be finding some sort of either plug-in piece at the rotation, which is probably the better move, considering I don't think they're going to overtake the Astros. So you're playing for a wild card spot. You're playing for a 50-50 chance to make the DS. And to me, that says go get a smaller pitching piece to hold them over.
Yeah, I mean, it's not hard to improve a good bit over a guy like Sam Gaviglio or Christian Bergman. I mean, Bergman, though he's been pitching well recently, I actually shouldn't disparage that guy. But yeah, I think that even getting a, you know, third or fourth starter would be enough of an upgrade to really make a difference to this team, probably. So I'm kind of with you on that. It's just a matter of, yeah, who's left to deal? Can you find a team to take on Dan Vogelbach and make that a part for a deal? Or, you know, is it maybe Max I don't know how you pronounce his last name, Pops?
Yeah,
it's a tough question, but I think if anybody's going to try to be creative about it, it's probably DePoto.
Yeah, you may end up with this. You may end up with one of the Guillermo Heredia, Taylor Motter, Ben Gamel, like, conglomerate of almost starting outfielders. You may end up with one of them being expendable if you get the outfield healthy again, to the point where the Reds are the team that come to mind as just like they will take a shot on someone like Ben Gamel and see what happens. So you could find a team that maybe sees something in someone enough to get, you know, that fourth starter type at the deadline. It's not going to be the move that makes waves other than in Jerry DePoto world.
Right.
But that seems like something they have the roster to do without necessarily trying to dig into the minors too far.
Well, so I think my general consensus is that I like this move for the Mariners. I like the move for Segura, and I don't know. Would you kind of agree on kind of a holistic level, or do you think it's just going to be one of those wait and see things?
I think it's a shot you had to take. If
Yeah.
you're the Mariners and you're looking at that roster right now, I think Segura was an easy sign. Yeah.
All right, so we'll move on to our next move, which is that actual trade that we were alluding to earlier. The Rangers finally parted ways with their erstwhile closer, Sam Dyson. They designated him for assignment earlier in the about a week ago, and then they immediately dealt him off to the Giants, sending along cash and only receiving in return a player to be named later. Boy, this was a quick fall for Sam Dyson, wasn't it?
Yeah, it turned bad really fast. That is it. And you just, I don't know, for Sam Dyson personally, I would have, if I were his friend, I would have wanted him to go somewhere where maybe there would be less scrutiny, maybe a really good bullpen where he can kind of test it out and maybe be the like low leverage sixth or seventh inning guy for a little while, see if he can put it together. And that's not what's happening here with the Giants. I mean, this is guy in highly scrutinized failing role going to bullpen known for imploding.
And highly scrutinized failing roles.
Yeah, it's just the first sign that he has trouble in San Francisco is just going to be the same thing all over again with basically everyone who ever goes to the Giants bullpen. But it's not the ideal situation, I don't think, but the Giants are taking a shot because maybe they can fix him, I guess.
Yeah, I'm very surprised that I'm not surprised that the Giants would make a move to try to shore up their bullpen, but it seems like the kind of guy where if they can't fix him within a week, this is going to go south very quickly, like kind of like you said. And I'm just I'm shocked that this has kind of not righted itself yet with the inability to get the ball over the plate and to throw strikes consistently. I think he's going to need an off season to try to get himself together if he's ever going to come back.
Yeah, his walks per nine is wow. his walks per nine is 6.48 this year, which is a lot. I don't know. He used to have the sinker baller thing that just kind of worked. It was not as good as some of the other sinker ballers in the league, but it was enough for him to be like a highly effective reliever for even back in 2014 when he was with the Marlins, a very effective reliever for the 42 innings where he kind of first made his name. And then with the Rangers for part of 2015 and all of 2016, just extremely effective, doing his thing, getting ground balls, closing out games, and occasionally fighting with various members of the Blue Jays. But this is just, he just lost it. I don't know. This is a thing that happens with relievers, and I don't know how to, like, there's such small samples, and there's so much pressure on a guy like Dyson when he's already in this high pressure role and then is having an issue on top of that. It just seems like it builds into this avalanche a lot faster than if like a starter struggles for a couple starts. There's just more riding on each pitch, and it just seems to get worse faster, and I don't know how you break him out of that cycle.
Yeah, I think you put him in the San Francisco Giants bullpen where people have had loads of success recovering from horrible, horrible outings. Can we talk for a second? I think that Mark Melancon has kind of righted the ship, and so maybe the Giants bullpen situation isn't as dire as it had been before, because he seems to be pitching well, if rather infrequently for this team. Maybe this wasn't such a bad deal after all.
I think Melanson's fine. I think that, I mean, we would not be talking about Melanson as any sort of issue if the Giants had any, like, games to use him in as a
Right.
closer. So in that way, yeah, maybe they're a lot better. I guess when you're the last place team in the NL West, the bullpen doesn't really matter as much as everything else that's gone wrong.
Right.
But It just, yeah. Melanson has not been bad. I don't think I'm going to check this before I say it out loud. I don't think Derek Law has been bad. Yeah, he's been fine. He hasn't been great. How is he giving up home runs? So it's a tricky thing. The bullpen is probably not the problem with the Giants at the moment, but they also don't have a great bullpen still. So if they intend to contend next year or try and do something, they might as well collect assets and see if they can stumble into a good reliever again.
Yeah, well, it'll kind of remains to be seen. But if Dyson comes back strong for 2018, this will look like a great deal in hindsight. Otherwise, this is going to be another in a series of Giants bullpen misfires, which we're pretty used to by now. So I don't think it'll devastate anyone too badly.
No.
All right, so a couple of other smaller moves to review real quickly. The Twins claimed Chris Heston off waivers from the Dodgers, making Heston, the former Giants pitcher, pretty well traveled this season. So he went to the Dodgers, then went to the Dodgers. Now he's with the Twins. This situation looks like it might be a little different because it looks like Heston might actually get a chance to start in Minnesota, where they've had some trouble filling out the back end of their rotation. It didn't seem like he was going to get that opportunity in Los Angeles with the Dodgers. So what do you think? Do you think this could be a useful part for the Twins, or is this kind of just another fungible back of the rotation swingman, longman type starter here?
I think it might be both. I think that that person is probably still useful for the Twins. Hector Santiago, I don't know exactly what like slot he is in the Twins rotation, but like he was bad yesterday.
Yeah, he was.
He and Chris Heston are actually the same age, which, wow. Chris Heston took a long time to get to the majors, but why not? Let's see if Chris Heston can play for the Twins. I don't know. There's no downside to this for the Twins. Maybe Chris Heston would be better in the bullpen and they can try him there, because if you can name the Twins bullpen, you probably watch too much Twins baseball. But it's just they could use pitching to plug in and see what happens. And he is at least someone who has thrown real major league innings and not been terrible before. Mm-hmm. So obviously the trick is kind of going to be whether he can get that strikeout rate back up just a little bit to where it was in 2015. But he has had some trouble getting strikeouts and avoiding walks since then. But maybe he can put it together in Minnesota.
Perhaps we'll see. The tough thing for the Twins is that Santiago, coming off that injury, is now going to be moved to the 10-day disabled list. He's going to go get an MRI on his shoulder, which is a terrible sign. Hopefully it'll come off with no structural damage. But yeah, if he's going to spend some time on the disabled list, joining Phil Hughes on the disabled list, they don't have a lot of depth. It feels like we say this a lot about a lot of teams, but they don't have a lot of depth. Adam Wilk probably would have been the backup option, if not Heston. So I think that this is probably necessary, but I do think he's got maybe slightly more upside than some other replacement-level starting pitchers that could have been available to the Twins at this point. I have a little bit of a desire to see Chris Heston do well, and he's had a really nice ground ball rate in the past, and I think that might play well to the Twins' strengths right now. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of he's got to figure out a way to get his control under wraps, and if he could have done that, he probably would have already, so we'll just kind of have to wait and see.
Yeah, if you could plug in just, I mean, basically exactly what we said with the Mariners. If you could just find a couple league average-ish or slightly below pitchers to plug into the back of the rotation after Santana and Berrios, it would make a big difference, because if you have even a flash of something from Chris Heston, I mean, he's probably worth leaving in there and maybe booting a Kyle Gibson or someone out of the rotation when you get when you get Santiago back, or if Adalberto Mejia figures out how to not walk the world in the major leagues, you know, he would be a guy who could plug in there. But they're just looking for, you know, rotation members 3 through 5 if they're going to try and contend.
You know, just to talk briefly about Mejia, because I don't think he's gotten a lot of national play. He's really kind of interesting. I would love to see him try to wrangle that walk rate, but, you know, between him and Berríos, he kind of had a similar issue to Berríos when he came up last season with the control issues, but a lot of strikeout stuff. It's weird to me seeing the Twins bring up young pitchers who are kind of okay and striking guys out. I feel it makes me feel strange things to see Twins players actually doing that.
Yeah, we should note that, like, he did not have a walk problem in the minors, like, at all.
No,
Adalberto
no.
Mejia had a just terrific minor league numbers where he was striking out like 22 to 25% of the batters he faced and only walking about 6 of them in like the upper minors, like multiple seasons at AA and AAA where he was doing this. And so I don't really think that I think like 35 to 40 innings in the majors so far is necessarily a reflection of what they've got. It's probably just kind of a learning period where he's not exactly sure how to do what he wants to do yet. Maybe he's trying to work on the edges of the zone and isn't quite getting it right where he wants it. But yeah, I think they probably have something there. They maybe don't want to give him they don't want him to experience so much failure that he loses a little bit of confidence. But yeah, I mean, in AAA this year, he literally has a 3.8% walk rate, which is great. So
it's weird that he's having kind of a similar issue, because Berríos didn't have a walk issue in the minors really either until he came up with the Twins last year. So I don't know. It's always one of those things where it's worth wondering about. Maybe someone who's more of a Twins expert than either of us could talk a little bit about maybe this having to do something with, I don't know, maybe an approach that they're taking with their starters in the majors, or, you know, they're asking these guys to do things that they're not comfortable doing, or if it's just really an issue of, pitching in the majors is a lot harder than pitching in Rochester. We can't figure out how to throw strikes in the big leagues right away.
Yeah.
Food for thought. Well, maybe we should get Aaron Gleeman on the show and he can talk to us a little bit about it.
He can probably name all of the Twins' bullpen pieces. That he could do it for sure.
Oh, man. Somebody's got to. All right, so we have one or two other really minor moves. I think we'll talk briefly about Ryan Rayburn. We spoke about this. He was traded to the Nationals, and he's been called up to the big club. Jason Worth's heading to the DL, so why not bring up Ryan Rayburn to replace him? So Ryan Rayburn is with the big club. Anything worthwhile talking about Rayburn and his role with the Washington Nationals?
There's exactly one thing I want to talk about. Ryan Rayburn has started 2 games for the Nationals now. He started on June the 5th against the Dodgers and June the 7th against the Dodgers. And he played left field in both cases. Whatever, they needed a fill-in out there while Jason Worth is nursing an injury. And this is kind of the Chris Heisey role, at least in my mind, that he was also filling in. I think Chris Heisey's injured too.
He is, yeah.
So they're plugging in that exact role. But for whatever reason, when Rayburn showed up, Dusty Baker plugged him into the lineup and decided he should hit second. This is a lineup that has, I think this forced Anthony Rendon, who hit 3 homers and drove in 10 runs in a game like a month ago, to the 6th spot. And I just don't understand. Like, maybe it's a confidence thing where you've got this new guy and you want him to plug in and get really good pitches to hit and get going, and then you flip the lineup around. Although I'm not exactly confident that that's what's happening, because I know earlier in the season there was a day shortly after the Eaton injury where the Nationals put the, like, it started popping up, you know, all the reporters were tweeting the Nationals lineup to see what it would look like without Eaton, and he had just plugged Michael A. Taylor right into the second hole. And then, like, less than an hour later, it was like, oh, the Nationals have a new lineup, and Michael A. Taylor had been moved down to the 8th spot, and, like, the actual good hitters had been moved into the correct spots, and it just I thought for sure that what had happened is someone from the front office had walked down and been like, you know, we can't do that.
Right.
And this makes me think that maybe that's not what's happening, that they're just a very laissez-faire front office and they're going to let Dusty Baker hit Ryan Rayburn second.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems to me like this just could be one of those issues where he has a heart of the lineup, guys that are really comfortable in their spots, or he's really comfortable in their spots. Because I just, you know, for a while he's been using that 3-4-5-6 of Harper, Zimmerman, Murphy, and Rendon, and it doesn't seem like he wants to really mess with that at all, which is kind of understandable. You don't want to mess with a good thing, but I'm shocked too. I mean, we've talked in Sabermetrics about the number two spot in the lineup being possibly the most important one, and so naturally that's not where you would want to put Ryan Rayburn ever.
Yeah, so. And I know that the lineup order is not something to get too bent out of shape about because it's not something that affects that much, especially on a one-game basis. It's not particularly likely to cost you anything, especially if you're the Nationals and you have a dozen-game lead. But it's just these kind of egregious moments that really stick out to me as it's not necessarily the biggest deal that you do it for two games, but at some point you're going to do it for like two games out of five in a postseason series, and it's going to be really frustrating for Nationals fans. And it seems like something you'd want to like maybe adapt to earlier. And so that's why I pointed out it's just a weird thing that they seem to do a lot.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good comparison. So I'm excited for the Ryan Rayburn era. I'm all in on Ryan Rayburn with the Nationals. I would like to point out that in the 2016 Baseball Prospectus Annual, I did toss a Bryce Harper comp on Ryan Rayburn as his as his comment for the annual because he hit so very well with the Indians that season. So being able to go Rayburn, Harper, 2 and 3 in that order is something that 2016 Brian would be super, super pumped for. So hopefully he'll make me look good, hit a few dingers, and thrive in that number two spot for what little time he spends there.
Absolutely. It's an odd year, so maybe.
It is an odd year. Like, you can say that, and it has both meanings, and they work just fine. All right, so our last move of the day is going to be the Braves sending the portly mascot of their team and most of Major League Baseball, Bartolo Colon, to the disabled list with what we understand is a case of being bad. And there are rumors that top pitching prospect for the Braves, Sean Newcomb, might be coming up to perhaps take his spot in the rotation. So what are your feelings on Colon for Newcomb that could swap for the Braves?
I think the thing we have to start with is just that it might be the end of the line for Bartolo Colon. He's doing, from what I can tell, like not much different. Everything looks basically the same, except for that he's just getting taken out of the yard over and over and over again.
That's the big thing.
He's even like, from what I can tell, changed up his pitch mix a little bit and stopped throwing the slider or stopped throwing the fastball like 89% of the time and dropped down to throwing it like 82% of the time, maybe. So it's just, he's trying to avoid the home runs and it's just not really working anymore. And the magic might be over for Bartolo Colon at age 44, which, just bringing it back to the original, the most franchises played for leader ever, Octavio Dotel, is still only 43. So if he wanted to add to his list, you know, he's got some inspiration. But it might be the end of the line for Bartolo Colon, and that's not exactly what you want to see.
No, it's not. I think in addition to the homers, there's a lot of good hard contact being made against him that's staying in the park. Over his career, almost like clockwork, his batting average on balls in play has been, you know, right around that 280 to 300 mark. This season, it's been a 353 BABIP, and if you watch the contact that hitters are making against him, they're catching up to his fastball, they're turning on it. It's not really an artifact of Now, granted, the Braves don't have a very good defense, but it's mostly on Cologne, I feel like, at this point, not on the other contextual factors, or even the potential, hitter-friendly park that he's been throwing in. I agree with you. It looks like he's just probably about done. He's not fooling hitters the same way that he needs to be effective. And so that brings us to the potential call-up for Sean Newcomb, who's a very, very talented hard-throwing left-hander. He's been a BP top 50 prospect overall, part of that Braves system that's gotten a lot of play as kind of a hotbed for young pitching. But here's my question: is it the right time to call him up with the Braves so far out of contention in the National League East? I mean, do you kind of feel like maybe the team should be saving some of his bullets for next year, or is this a good time to try to audition him when there's going to be a little bit less potential pressure on him to really perform well, given that the team is going nowhere fast, especially without Freddie Freeman?
I kind of lean toward the latter. I think it's possible that they don't view him as the tip of the spear, so to speak, anymore in their pitching prospects. I think they might be shifting toward thinking that the future ace is someone who's a little further away, like Colby Allard or Mike Soroka. I think one of those guys might be the super high potential guy they're looking at right now, who they might coddle a little more. Even I think Max Fried is pitching well again for them in the minors, and he's coming off a lot of injuries, and he probably isn't ready yet. But Newcomb, it may be that he's a guy that they want to go ahead and get major league experience and see what happens, because he's not maybe projected to be that number one or number two guy anymore. The issue I have with bringing him up at this point is the problem that he's always had is walks. He walks a lot of people, and he's not improving. I mean, it's not. There was a good change between 2015 and 2016. He went back to double A in 2016 after having played some there in 2015. And he did improve his walk rate, kept his strikeout rate the same, and that's all good. That's an improvement. That's what you'd want to see. But then they moved him up to triple A this year, and the walk rate went right back up, basically. The strikeout rate went up too, so he's clearly got really, really impressive stuff. I mean, he's striking out 11.5 people per nine in triple A. So maybe they think that the majors will help him in some way. I'm not really sure. He's going to be 24 next month, so it, or sorry, this month. He's going to be 24 this month. So maybe it's time, and they just throw him into the majors and see what happens without a lot of pressure of it being a year where they want to contend. But it's going to be dicey. I could really see him having some trouble with major league hitters who are patient, but it. Like I said, I'm not sure that he's the crown jewel of that system anymore.
It's kind of interesting. They marked him as the number 44 overall prospect in the BP Top 101 this season, which is pretty good. I mean, that's really, really, high-end upside for a starter. The thing that's so interesting to me is you're right to mention his control issues, which are problematic, and they'll continue to be problematic until they're adjusted a little bit. But he was so good in AAA this year, even despite all the walks. I mean, his DRA was under 2.5. So combine that with what you brought up about his age, with him being 24. Now might be the time to put him in the majors and see what he's got, and if not, start him on that path to being a Andrew Miller type reliever, perhaps. He's one of the few guys who really, from a stuff perspective, could potentially be that kind of relief pitcher from the left side. I just think that, you're probably right in that, given his age and given the fact that the Braves do have more guys coming who could be that number one type of caliber of pitcher, you may just want to throw him out there and see what happens. Guys only have a certain number of bullets in their arm. He's 24. He's got this velocity right now. Throw him out there, see if something will work. And unfortunately, he probably can't be worse than Cologne has been. So from a actual 2017 performance perspective, he may not be that much of a downgrade at all.
Yeah, I think it might be worth seeing. I don't really know how he's managed this, but he's not a big ground ball guy, but he's always had really, really great low home run rates. And I don't know enough about the parks he's played in to say anything substantive about that, but I know he's played in two different systems and lots of different parks, and the home run rate's always been really good. So I imagine he played in at least one park that wasn't super conducive and managed to hold it together. So maybe there's some skill there that's helping him with, you know, if he's going to walk people, which he is, maybe he's not going to give up the two-run, three-run home run as much as another guy or as much as the average guy might. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's something there. I don't think there's anything to lose with a soon-to-be 24-year-old taking a shot in the majors, and it'll at least be interesting. It's something to add some intrigue to the Braves season that hasn't been exactly what they wanted it to be.
I think when you get down to it, that's the best reason to be pro this move, is because, man, there's nothing good to watch for the Braves right now.
No.
I mean, it's fun to watch Ender and Ciarte play, and I continue to hold out hope that Dansby Swanson will come back and be the player that we kind of hoped he would be at the start of the season. He's not going to continue to slump as badly as he has to start this year. And I like watching Mike Foltynewicz pitch, so that's fun. But yeah, this isn't a team with a whole lot to root for. Not a lot of excitement, a lot of kind of mid-level veteran guys, and no Freddie Freeman. So this could be something at least really exciting and fun to watch every fifth day for a reason that's very different than watching Bartolo Colon pitch. So that's kind of nice.
Yeah, absolutely. The low-key thing to watch with Dansby Swanson that I've noticed is, I remember last year there was a bunch of talk about, you know, different guys who lose their helmets all the time, whether it was Bryce or Jose Ramirez on the Indians lost his helmet all the time.
Yep.
And Josh Harrison, Hanley Ramirez loses his helmet a lot. Dansby Swanson seems to not lose his helmet. He just seems to, the moment he's not actively doing something for the baseball game, he takes his helmet off as if to make sure that people recognize him with his hair as opposed to with the hat or helmet. We're recording this on Thursday, and last night he had this crazy slide into first base, and the moment, you know, before he even like called timeout, he had his helmet off and was like standing there with it, with his hair flowing in the breeze, and it's a storyline to watch. I think he may be actively attempting to only be seen with no hat on during baseball games, which is something to see.
Well, I mean, you got to get after that Jacob DeGrom, you know, head and shoulders money while you can get those endorsements. And if I had hair like Swanson or like some of these other guys, I'd probably flash that as often as possible myself. So good on him. It'd be nice to see him get a few extra hits, more opportunities for him to take off that helmet. But yeah, that's something I'll definitely keep an eye on. In between all the other exciting, I don't know, Adonis Garcia at-bats that we get from Braves games these days. So that'll about do it for our show today. Thank you very much for listening. You can find more information about the show at DFA Podcast on Twitter. You can find us on Baseball Prospectus constantly. And in addition to the show, you can find all sorts of great content at Baseball Prospectus. Short Relief, there's columns by dozens and dozens of people, great prospect coverage. One of those columns you can check out is Zach's Circle Change column. You want to give us a quick, brief mention of your column from Tuesday?
Sure. There was a game the previous Tuesday between the Marlins and the Phillies, which would otherwise be about as interesting as you would guess from that pitch. But it during the game, the broadcast somehow ended up on a split screen where they were comparing the swings of Justin Bour and Babe Ruth. And so I, having not paid that much attention to the game to that point, did not understand how they came to that conclusion of comparing those two swings. So I went way down the rabbit hole into looking at how they got there, and it turned into something a little more interesting than the game itself. So that was the column on Tuesday.
All right. Well, that's that sounds like fun. Everybody should go and check it out. We will fill your need for Justin Bour content at Baseball Prospectus. I'm not sure there are many players who are less covered than Justin Bour, thanks to the combination of him playing for the Marlins, a team that doesn't have the same coverage as a lot of other franchises, to his particular skill set, to him being kind of just, you know, what you'd consider, I guess, a league average or slightly worse first baseman. So, I mean, how could you not compare him to Babe Ruth, I guess?
He was leading the National League in home runs until Scott Schebler went deep yesterday.
Can you believe that you just said that sentence?
No, I cannot.
But. Justin Bour, Scott Schebler, guys who lead the National League in home runs in 2017. It feels like we're living in a game of, you know, like out of the park baseball that's gone just horribly wrong after, you know, 15 seasons, and some of the real players that you recognize have all moved out of the game, and you're just, it's all creative players at this point, it feels like.
You would have had an easier time convincing me that Giancarlo Stanton had changed his name again to Justin Bour, and that Joey Votto had adopted a nickname as Scott Schebler.
It's funny, but at the same time, like, Scott Schebler's pretty good now. there's some weird stuff going on in Cincinnati. I mean, we talked about Cozart, but Schebler and the Scooter Gennett game, which I think needs at least just some sort of mention, that I don't know how it's possible, but Scooter Gennett hit 4 home runs in a single game, and that's a thing now that's in baseball history that we all have to kind of like reconcile with ourselves. There are some weird things going on in Cincinnati this year, man.
Yeah, Scooter Gennett hitting 4 home runs will live forever somehow, and so will his Muppet-inspired nickname, which got more publicity after his weird game. So, lots of points to Scooter Gennett for continuing to go by a name that he got from the Muppets.
Just one quick thing on the subject of Scooter, our Muppet friend. Do you have 4 homer games that stick out in your head?
The one that I remember most clearly is probably Sean Green for some reason. I've never lived on the West Coast, not a Dodgers fan, but that was the one that really just like popped as maybe the first one I watched live. But I remember the Carlos Delgado one too, but Sean Green for sure is the one that sticks in my head.
Yeah, that was a big one for me. I don't know why, but the one that's always stuck with me is Mark Witten's back in 1993. Hard-hitting Mark Witten, hitting 4 homers in a game. I don't know why. It was just like some particular point in my baseball fandom that really just sticks with me. Whenever I think of a 4-homer game, I don't think of Delgado. I don't think of Green. I don't think of even Josh Hamilton's, which was, you know, previously the most recent one. I just always go back and think about Mark Witten. Which is weird. It's a really weird thing.
I do have a fun thing. I was looking at the Josh Hamilton game. Do you remember who started that game for the Orioles?
Oh, gosh, no.
Take a guess. Just take a guess.
Well, okay, starting pitcher for the Orioles five years ago, give or take. So, I was before Ubaldo was there. I don't really know. Was it Chris Tillman?
No, it was Jake Arrieta.
No, really?
Yeah, Jake Arrieta. I'm pretty sure Hamilton hit his first 2 home runs off Jake Arrieta before Jake Arrieta was a thing.
Oh, wow. That's so. That's a fun fact. I like that one.
Yeah.
Well, have you ever noticed, so there have been 15 guys who have hit 4 home runs or more in a game. Well, 4 home runs, obviously, not more than that. Have you ever noticed how many of them are at some point played for the New York Mets? It's pretty bizarre. You've got Delgado, Green, and Mike Cameron, and then also Willie Mays and Gil Hodges. So that's like 5 out of the 15.
That is not something that I had noticed, but I acknowledge that is weird. And the other thing about the Mark Witten game, that was also a Cardinals Reds game. He was obviously not on the Cardinals instead of the Reds.
Right.
But it was also a Cardinals Reds game, and I think he and Scooter Gennett also wore number 4 at the time they did this.
Oh, that's really weird. Can we get some? Let's see if we can get some.
Maybe that wasn't. Hold on, that might not be the thing. Scooter Jeanette wore number 4. Mark Whitten did not. What was the other thing that they shared? They had something in common. It might have been their career home run total or something.
Oh, weird.
Anyway, there were a lot of parallels in that game, which is interesting. But.
Bizarre. Well, the other thing that I was kind of mystified about is that other than Jeanette played left field in that game. But one of the things is that no middle infielder had ever hit 4 homers in a game. It's always been corner guys or center fielders. So I was really kind of like, I feel like in his heart still, Scooter Jeanette is a second baseman, even though he played left field in that game. So I kind of feel like morally that's a victory for the middle infielder, finally getting a four dinger game. But I don't think the play index will back me up on that.
Now, do you think that Scooter Jeanette will pass 1890s Boston Bean Eaters legend Bobby Lowe and not have the fewest career home runs for anyone who's hit 4 homers in a game? He's at 42, and Bobby Lowe was finished with 71.
Boy. I think he beats it. I think he sticks around for 7 more years. The Orioles will probably need a backup infielder in 4 or 5 years, and he can take that role. Yeah, no, I think he'll eventually hold out long enough. It might take him a few years, but I think he'll do it.
If he does it by the end of this year, that would really be something.
That would be awesome. I would be so so for that. Can you imagine? Probably major league home run leader Scooter Jeanette. Number 2 Scott Schebler.
Both on the Reds.
Yeah. Oh, that would be fun. Talk about this really, when you said it's an odd year, you weren't kidding about it.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for listening, everyone. We'll catch you next time on the DFA Podcast.